Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, which is through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm great, man.
I've got some serious news. I want to play a little game with you.
Yes, I'm listening.
Ready for a little game this morning?
I'm ready for the game.
I'm going to read you the beginning of an article in the newspaper, and I'm going to read you the beginning of an email that was forwarded to me from someone else, and I want you to guess what the subject is.
Okay.
You ready? Okay. This from Time in partnership with CNN. Dateline, March 13th. Richard Hebron, 41, was driving along an anonymous stretch of highway near Ann Arbor, Michigan last summer when the state cops pulled him over, ordered him to put his hands on the hood of his mud-splattered truck, and seized its contents. Okay?
Mm-hmm, I got it.
Okay. What do you think was in the truck?
Heroin.
No, but that's a good guess.
What cocaine. Else?
No. Hold on a second. I'll give you the other email. This is an email sent out to the distribution list of a friend of mine.
Okay.
This woman's obviously a supplier as well. She writes, I've been doing this for almost 3 years. I haven't been caught yet. Am I on borrowed time? I've been becoming more and more paranoid about doing this. Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. I don't require prepayment, which means that if I'm stopped and arrested, the contents of my car would be confiscated, and I would be out over $2,000 for whatever I just paid for your orders and mine as well. If I decide to resume doing this ever, I'll require prepayment. I'm scared. I'm getting out. What are these two people talking about?
It's got to be pot, then, if it's not cocaine or heroin.
How about raw milk? Our society is crazy. Why are we persecuting people who just want to drink raw, unpasteurized milk?
I have no idea.
I
read through these two things, and the letter that was forwarded to us a little while ago, and you and I kind of decided not to read it on the air to kind of...
The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
But we decided not to read it on the air, but this is, it's just getting worse. You know, Richard Hebron gets pulled over, and they confiscate...
They make him put his hands on his truck as if he's going to pull out, like, a hidden stick of butter and throw it at them, right? They seize 453 gallons of raw milk, 29 quarts of cream, and 35 pounds of raw butter. $7,000 of a small farmer's stuff, okay? Look, raw milk is unpasteurized milk. It's illegal because there was a lot of really terrible, unsanitary milk being produced when they made pasteurization mandatory. But there are a lot of the health benefits of milk that are lost. And you can go to Dr. Ron Schmid's website, which you can find a link through our website, to find out all the health benefits of raw milk. But the real thing this is about is consumer choice, okay? They've just told us, don't worry, you can have milk from a cloned cow.
Right.
No problem.
And I think you should regulate it. I think that you should have to pass very, very stringent tests at your farm if you want to serve raw milk.
I got no problem with that.
I think you should have to have a whole set of criteria that you have to go through in order to sell raw milk. But there are some states that say it's legal and some states that say it's not. New Jersey, for instance, is one where you're not allowed to buy raw milk. And Pennsylvania is one where you are allowed to, in certain circumstances, buy raw milk.
What they do in Pennsylvania is you can buy a share of a cow.
Of a cow.
And then you get that portion of the milk from that cow.
My dad actually has a share of a cow in Pennsylvania right now.
Well, driving across the border to get that milk is a pain in the butt for milk every day because, raw milk is, fresh and it goes bad like it should. Actually, what's interesting, I don't know if you know this out there in listener land, but pasteurized milk turns sour and separates and gets all smelly. You know what happens to wholesome raw milk when it gets old? Turns to yogurt. You know how they figured that out? They used to put the milk in the sack on the back of the yak, and,
and
when the yak got to where it was going, it was yogurt. So, you know, the other thing about...
That was kind of gross, too, because they kind of counted on the sweat of the yak to permeate the bag.
No.
Yeah, gross stuff.
Whatever. we don't use yaks in modern milk making. But raw milk enthusiasts have an inspector that insists that along with the bad pathogens, heat-treating milk destroys beneficial bacteria, proteins, and enzymes that aid in digestion. In fact, people with a history of digestive tract problems, like Crohn's disease, swear by the powers of unpasteurized milk. Dr. Schmid and also Dr. Joseph Mercola, who's an osteopathic physician and author, they have tremendous successes where people who are allergic, who are quote-unquote lactose intolerant, or who are allergic to milk, when you give them raw milk, they don't seem to be allergic, and a lot of their allergies go away. I mean, milk has been around for a long time. You know, the land of milk and honey, it's the only food mentioned in the Bible besides honey. It's, you know, milk and honey are the only two foods that are created as nature to be food.
Well, there are a lot of people climbing on this bandwagon now, as far as the words are the curative powers of milk.
I've heard tell that our Secretary of Agriculture here in New Jersey is open to the idea, and I certainly hope that he is, legalizing and regulating raw milk sales. You think people are willing to pay a premium for organic, and they are. They're really willing to pay a premium for raw milk.
Yeah, we should send them a little note and let them know that we're strong supporters.
If you believe that raw milk sales should be legal or illegal in New Jersey, why don't you email us, francis@restaurantguysradio.com. Eitherway.com. Read your opinions on the air at the very least, or maybe we'll call you up and we can have a little chit-chat about it.
I'll tell you, the rest of this woman's email was just I felt so bad for her. This woman who was trying to spread the word of unpasteurized milk and bring it to people who wanted it. It was just so sad. I mean, she's sitting here saying, you know, you have no idea how much time, work, and stress this job is lately.
Let me give you an update. Since she stopped delivering raw milk because she got spooked, and, you know, it's actually not technically illegal if you own a share of a cow in Pennsylvania. But if she's transporting it, you know, she can't be out the money, and it's a lot of work. What she has done and many others have done are there are now groups actively working to legalize raw milk sales in the state of New Jersey. You can find out about them by going to our website and look at the shows we've done on raw milk with Dr. Schmid. And I'll try and put a link up tonight for some of the new organizations that are out there trying to make this good and wholesome food available in our state. Really amazing stuff. When we come up, we're going to be talking again with Letty Teague. She's a noted wine expert. And yesterday she was nominated for a James Beard Award for her work in Food and Wine magazine. And we'll be talking with her about wine in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And our guest today returning is Letty Teague. She's an executive editor at Food and Wine magazine, where she writes the monthly column Wine Matters, for which she won the 2003 James Beard MFK Fisher Distinguished Writing Award. And yesterday she was nominated again for a column there for a couple of articles. Are the wine lists at steakhouses any good? Secret Life of a Wine Salesman. Are Super Tuscans still super? She joins us again today to discuss her new book, Educating Peter.
Letty, welcome back to the show.
Hey, guys. Nice to be back.
Hey, congratulations on your James Beard Award nomination.
Thanks.
Big stuff.
I was at the Beard House yesterday morning. I was actually biting down on a croissant as they mentioned your name.
I hope you didn't choke on it.
No, I thought, I have her tomorrow. I've got her tomorrow.
Okay.
So are the wine lists at steakhouses any good?
Did we talk about that before?
No, we talked about the secret life of a wine salesman. And I remember that because you came on.
Fine, any good? No.
Well, I'm going to tell you why I remember that we talked about the secret life of a wine salesman last time you were on.
No, I do remember that. Yeah.
Well, it's also because you came on the week after we did the author of the book, The Secret Life of Lobsters.
So anything with the word secret in it?
It was like a theme, I guess.
Secret food and wine. We were doing the secrets of food and wine was our theme.
So tell us about, I want to talk about your book, but tell us about, because I didn't get a chance to read Are the Wine Lists at Steakhouses.
You really
want
to talk about steakhouses, not Educating Peter as
much. I do, actually, but I want to know, are the wine lists at steakhouses any good?
Well, if you have a lot of money and a penchant for California Cabernet, then absolutely.
How about a rich friend?
If you have a rich friend that has a penchant for California Cabernet, then absolutely. Or Bordeaux maybe, but less so. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's just a the mold, you know, or the so the stamp, you know, with which all steakhouses are marked by is really pretty extraordinary. You know, to a list like this is the formula. This is how much Napa cab you're going to have, and this is how much you're going to believe people are willing to pay, which is a lot.
And it is a lot.
It's a lot of points and a lot of dollars. You add up the numbers on those lists, my God.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, let's turn the conversation to your book, Educating Peter, which we thought was great.
Oh,
I mean,
thanks.
Really,
I'm
really
surprised by that fact.
Actually, I got to tell you though, Letty, we read
with limited expectations.
we read a lot of stuff that's not so great.
Okay? Well, no, I mean, whenever I look at a wine education book, I often
boring or stupid.
It's either way too technical for anybody who's not an expert to enjoy,
right.
Or it's so simple and boring. And this was
wildly
fun.
Insulting. Oh, thanks. I owe a lot of that to my hero or anti-hero, Peter Travers. You know, who just was great in asking, you know, all the questions. You know, that you would tell him something and he would immediately want to know why. You know, it's like having a idiot savant. You know, and his wife just called him an idiot.
Why don't you? But you said savant.
You also called him a savant.
Yeah. So
maybe you could call him protagonist, I guess.
Yeah,
maybe
protagonist. That's
he plays the
word.
Piano. Anyway, yeah. Why don't you tell our listeners the way the book is structured and the premise of the book, because it's brilliant.
Okay. Okay, well, you know, it started out, and it's funny because it doesn't say this on the book itself, but it started out as a column series for which I actually won a James Beard Award that they didn't even mention, but for the series, you know, of Educating Peter, and the book grew out of that. But the idea was to take someone that knew nothing about wine and had all kinds of wild prejudices against it. In fact, Peter had a prejudice against everything except what he called fatty Chardonnay, which is this really, really, really big oaky Chardonnays, and would drink nothing else, and was incredibly opinionated and articulate on the subject. He was a perfect pupil. But I thought if I could take this one man, and Peter Travers is the hero, and I should back up and say he's also a very famous film critic. He's a film critic for Rolling Stone magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Does a lot of television. He had a show on CNN. He still does a lot of appearances there and on Charlie Rose and so forth. So he's a very, very articulate, very funny guy. But I thought if I could take someone like as entrenched as Peter Travers and show him the world of wine and the way that the book unfolds, as I take Peter through. It's laid out in a pretty traditional fashion. You know, we, as most wine books, you know, we go through, all the wines of the old world, i.e., France and Germany and Italy and Austria and New World and the United States, Argentina, Chile, South Africa, blah blah blah. We talk about grapes. I take Peter on a bunch of field trips. You know, to a wine auction. Where it's actually terrifying. He morphs from this man that would only pay $10 a bottle to a guy that's like, that's only $12,000.
What steal?
Sit down. Was it
a testosterone rush that it became a competition?
He wanted, because actually, if you've ever been to a wine auction, they're deadly dull. So I think he just wanted to inject some energy in the place because everyone there is incredibly serious. I mean, they're there to conduct business. I mean, they're almost, with the exception of all the lawyers in the place, who are the only guys that can get out in the middle of the day when most auctions take place. You know, they're sommeliers, they're wine directors or guys buying for the restaurant, as you guys as restaurants.
Been there, done that.
Yeah, exactly, as you know. So Peter's like, what's going on? You know, this is really boring. They're just people sitting around whispering, and so he just thought, I have to inject some energy in this and begin to gesticulate wildly and extensively, but thank goodness he didn't. And then from there we went on other field trips. We went to restaurants where important part of learning about wine is learning how to talk to others about wine, particularly sommeliers, making your needs known, because that was the other thing. Peter had he was terrified, as I think a lot of people are.
Mm-hmm. I think most people are. I think that is a very common that people are intimidated by someone who may know more than they do,
right.
When really what most people want is just to communicate their needs.
Right. Right, and then to develop enough of a vocabulary and an assurance and a history with wine, so you can do that. So at least as sommelier, you have a reference point for him or her, so
right.
That, they can better help you.
I think that's part of what makes this book great. Is it's not just about learning facts; it's about overcoming intimidation. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come right back and talk more with Letty Teague about her book, Educating Peter: How I Taught a Famous Movie Critic the Difference Between Cabernet and Merlot. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey. 1450, the time is 1125.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, stage left, and Catherine Lombardi. And we're talking with Letty Teague, a noted wine author, about her book, Educating Peter, How I Taught a Famous Movie Critic the Difference Between Cabernet and Merlot. Letty, we were talking before about how this book sort of breaks down intimidation about wine as you take this other person and hopefully the reader at the same time through the process of learning about wine. And one of the first things you need to do is to be able to talk about wine to give people an idea of what it is that you want in a restaurant. How do you do that?
You need a tasting vocabulary, and those are the kinds of things that you talk about in the book.
Right, exactly. You need an ability to describe wine, to describe wine, certainly. And Peter came up with some really wild ways in which to describe wine, very unconventional, I would say. But actually my favorite was when he first encountered Sauvignon Blanc. He would say that's a wine that makes you say ouch. So it's always a wine that, so, you know, are you going to give me one of those ouch wines? You know, people just aren't going to know what you mean by that. So I said, you know, in that case, you have to say wines with high acidity would be what you would be referencing in that case. But,
well, it's funny when we teach people, they say something like that and they think they're wrong, and they're not
right.
Wrong.
No, they're not. Mm-hmm. No, it's just that not everyone will understand them.
Right, you need to find the word that other people will understand who know
exactly
about wine, what that
so
means.
You do have to conform to convention to some degree. Uh-huh. But, you know, the other important thing is just to taste enough wine so you have a sense of what it is that you like, maybe not necessarily a producer, but at least a grape or a style. And, you know, and that's something that if you can articulate that to a retailer or a restaurant, you know, sommelier, then you can at least give them a point of reference. And this is, I think, also important but less often said, is that it also doesn't make you seem like a complete idiot. And you want to always come from a position of strength. I think with not all sommeliers, but some sommeliers where if they think that you know a little bit, they're care, you know, probably
yeah.
even more so, then they're much more responsive, which I think, you know, is probably true of most people because they care so passionately. So if you even if you don't know very much, it's like speaking a language. You know,
that's,
if you try to speak.
It's exactly the
except French.
Thinking,
you should
yeah.
never try to speak French.
you can actually hurt yourself.
All the more for that.
And you can actually hurt yourself speaking French with the
or
Flemish
hurt,
thing in the background.
Hurt, yeah.
But the other thing is that I think that a useful tip that our listeners can take is that at the very basic level, when you talk to a wine salesman or a sommelier, if you know a wine that you like,
mm-hmm.
say, like, if someone comes to me and says, well, what do you have? And they say, well, I like Sancerre.
Right.
And then I can say, well, do you want a wine that's like Sancerre? Do you want a wine that's different? Try something new that's different than Sancerre.
Right.
At least we begin the process of communication.
Right, right, exactly.
Letty, we have to go listen to the news, but will you stay with us and come back on the other
sure,
side?
Sure, absolutely.
Terrific. Again, we're talking with Letty Teague about her book, Educating Peter. You can find out more about it and even order it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back after the news. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today, we're talking with Letty Teague. She's an executive editor at Food & Wine Magazine. She writes a monthly column for them. She's an award-winning journalist, an author, and her current book is Educating Peter, How I Taught a Famous Movie Critic the Difference Between Cabernet and Merlot. Now, Letty, you took in the book you take Peter through learning about wine, and he starts out really just liking big oaky Chardonnay and nothing else, and being quite set in his ways.
Right.
When does he start to see the light? When does he start to become enthusiastic about wine?
Well, I think the first wine that really made an impact on him, or I should say grape, was Riesling. Because first of all, it's so aromatically beguiling, great Riesling. I mean, you have this wonderful, floral aromas and mineral aromas, and it just had unlike Chardonnay, which is there's so much that is not necessarily fruit going on with that wine in most cases. It's a lot of oak, and there, he discovered this sort of purity of flavor that was just a revelation. It's like, I can taste something that isn't just this sort of, surrounding the fruit. And I think that was, that was really, so it had a distinctive aroma, and it had a distinctive, clarity of flavor. Even. Yep.
Francis teaches a wine class and has in the restaurant for the 15 years since we've been open in the restaurant, and we always start with Riesling, and you always see people like wide-eyed, saying like, "What is this thing that I've never encountered before?"
Right.
It's not this sickly sweet Blue Nun that I had when I was 17 years old on the railroad tracks.
By the railroad tracks.
Mark lives in a tough neighborhood. Mark evidently lives in a tougher neighborhood than I knew.
Or the train, or we
No. It's just a slight. The only wooded area in Nutley, New Jersey, is around the railroad tracks.
But you get out of the way of the train.
We'll still find like cases of Blue Nuns.
The Bomb Strang Mad Dog 2020 and Mark and friends. Now, so how did things go with Peter, and we're talking, of course, about Peter Travers, who's the movie critic for Rolling Stone magazine, who was the subject here, the object of your education here,
an occasional derision. we're still friends.
Was there resistance to anything along the way? Was there stuff that he's like, "Yeah, Letty, I just don't get it. I don't see why you would do that." With wine.
There was actually one grape, one wine in particular that he had a violent reaction to, and I have to say that I don't disagree, and it's a Pinotage, the hideous grape that South Africa is determined to call its own, although
Plonk.
I think they're like mowing it under as we speak.
So. I remember people,
they had Pinotage.
Yeah.
I hope it's not on your wine list.
Actually, there is no Pinotage on our wine list. There are 1,000 selections, but there is no Pinotage.
But it's funny, there was such a marketing push behind Pinotage, and there's all this stuff written about it when it first came out, and the South African reps would be like, "Oh, I know you have to try the Pinotage." I'm like, "All right, I'm trying it.
Okay.
I'm not buying it."
All right, there's almost no Pinot Noir that I wouldn't rather have than your Pinotage.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we had a wine, actually, that Peter insisted that we bury the bottle in the backyard. It was so, it was like,
did you actually do it?
Enough to pour it out. It had to be, entombed.
Did you actually do it?
No, it's surprising. I don't take everything that Peter said. I did, and then when we got to our retail store outings, because I took him after we did all the restaurants, I took him to retail stores so he could talk to retailers. And this woman that he liked very much up to a certain point, but then he saw who was the store clerk, and then he thought very well of her until he saw the prodigious display of Pinotage, and he said, "You don't really like that, do you?" And she said, "No, but I can't say that openly." And he's like, "Oh, thank God."
Well, now.
Acres.
There are so many wines out there, and we are, as a culture in the United States, so subjected to marketing. And so many of the, and I talked about the wine class that Francis teaches every year. So, and one of the things we do is we take one of those heavily marketed wines, and we always put it in our wine tasting.
That's
wine,
a smart idea.
And let people say, "Okay, well, this is what you're paying the Pinot Grigio that you've been paying $25 or $30 for," and I won't give names. I'll let you
do. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Thank you, Letty. But the Pinot Grigio.
That does really well.
that you're paying. All this money for,
and here's one you've never heard of from a small farmer.
Just isn't right. And here's this small farmer who produces this delightful either American Pinot Gris or Italian Pinot Grigio,
and it's $10 a bottle less.
Right,
and it blows it out of the water.
That always amazes me. Did you and Peter have any of those experiences with some of those high marketed wines?
Well, actually, Grigio was exactly. He has his really good friend, a woman named Anne Martin, and I've witnessed her penchant for Santa Margherita Pinot Grigio, and Peter would say every time she comes to dinner, I have to buy Santa Margherita Pinot Grigio, which is very expensive now. I think it's like $25 a bottle.
Isn't
I don't
crazy?
Know what it is. $30 really?
No, I said crazy.
Okay, great. I was gonna say, wow, you guys are a mark up there in New Jersey. but he was like, you know what? I want to find something else because it doesn't taste like anything to me. And mind you, this is Peter's part of his evolution. He said, but basically, it was like he wanted to save money. So we set out and it found, there are a couple really like Chris, KRIS is a dynamite Pinot Grigio. I think it's like $12 a bottle
right.
or something. But then subsequently, almost every Italian white wine that we had, Peter would say, well, this is a great Santa Margherita Pinot Grigio substitute. You know, it was like that was forever. It's like Vermentino, Suave. Mm-hmm. That was certainly a wine that. But I think it's also because cheap. Peter is cheap, as well as.
By the way, that's not a bad motivator.
And I believe in being cheap. Certainly.
And there's I'd like to be as decadent as I can. I'm just not rich enough.
Let somebody else be decadent on your behalf.
Well, that's why I'm a professional, so I get invited to all the tastings and I get to taste all these wines. I don't have to pay for them.
Right.
I think that people don't realize that, and one of the things that's really nice about your book and about Peter being cheap is there's a whole world of adventure in the under $15 a bottle and
right.
under $10 a bottle
right.
range of wines.
Oh, I mean, this is like we're living in the golden era of brilliant wine, well, not brilliant, but extremely well-made wines under $15. Yeah.
But generally in that price range, you can't say, can I have a Napa Valley Valley Cabernet?
Yeah, I mean, there are exceptions.
You
can
got
say
it.
Under $100. Can
right. I exactly. But if you're willing to experiment, if you're willing to look outside the box a little bit,
right.
there are tons of spectacular wines from southern Italy, which you talk about in the book, from France, from other places in the world, even from other parts of the United States.
What
right.
bargain wines, what categories would you suggest that people, if they find a knowledgeable wine merchant like Brian from Township Liquors, who advertises on our show or us,
mm-hmm.
If they find a knowledgeable wine merchant and they want to not spend a lot of money, but they want to experiment in regions, where are some places that you suggest people go to look for wine?
Find great value. Broad regional terms, I would say the Loire Valley for white wines. The 05 vintage is excellent vintage. I would say Sicily and Campania for reds and Campania and for whites. I would say Mendoza, the Malbecs in Argentina. I would say Chile for Sauvignon Blanc, really dynamite Sauvignon Blancs. I would say I would say the Languedoc. Well, maybe a little less so in France, but there are some really good values.
In California, yeah. Are there any good values to be had in this country?
There's some really well-made wines from Mendocino in terms of greater value, some really terrific Pinots. I think, Zin is still a good value wine because there's an unfair prejudice against it, exactly. It becomes harder, but certainly they exist. Washington State, I find there's some terrific values there. Oregon, not so much so. I feel like that's one state where Pinot has gotten, I think, overvalued.
I want to talk to you about that when we come back because I couldn't agree more, and I get stuff thrown at me whenever I say it. But we'll come back in just a moment talking more with Letty Teague. She's an executive editor of Food & Wine Magazine, and her book is Educating Peter, or How Anybody Can Become an Almost Instant Wine Expert. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standard set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com.
¶¶
everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with Letty Teague. Her book is Educating Peter. It has two subtitles. I've read them one and the other, so don't get confused.
You never have enough subtitles.
It's the same book. You can find it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Now, we talked right before the commercial about Oregon. I went to Pinot Noir camp out in Oregon many years ago, and I've been in Oregon, and I've gone for the wineries. And with one, I found wonderful people who make, like you said, very good Pinot Gris, which is a white wine. With one glaring exception, I really wasn't blown away with Oregon Pinot Noir overall.
Mm-hmm.
What do you seem to agree with me? Why do you think that is?
Well, in terms of price
value.
Quality ratio.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, I've had some very good wines, but you know, just wines that are the prices are too high, and I feel like, you know, they had some excellent vintages, and I feel like prices went way up, you know, accordingly, and then some less successful vintages and some not so fabulous wines have followed, but prices haven't necessarily, you know, reflected that. And I feel like, is it having secured a place, you know, a certain foothold in the market, you know, that they're you know, unwilling to back off from that for perception reasons or what have you. But I just feel like, you know, I found a lot of wines that are really too heavily oaked. And you know, just sort of lack concentration, and I feel like I've just had more interesting wines coming from, you know, from the Anderson Valley in Mendocino and from Sonoma Coast in California. And I, you know, like you said, I mean, there's some lovely winemakers, and that's not to paint the entire area with, you know, an enormously broad brush, but I guess I am. So.
Which we kind of did. It's just exactly what I was thinking.
I want to interject that there's one winemaker out there who really blows me away with everything he does, and that's a guy named Tony Soder at Soder Vineyards.
Tony Soder. And Doug Tinnell, I think he is.
Yes,
really, really
I agree.
Talented.
Those guys are really, but they're operating in a very high league. What I did when I was out there, though, I drove all around. And I was in Washington, you can sort of say a wine tastes like it comes from Washington.
Mm-hmm.
In the Napa Valley, you can have a wine that sort of tastes, or the Russian River Valley in Sonoma, wine that sort of tastes like it comes from mm-hmm. Sonoma. I couldn't find that common thread where I could say, you know, this tastes like Oregon. Could you?
Right.
Could you?
I think that's a fair thing to say. I think it's really hard. It's funny, I was having this conversation with another wine writer. It's like, you know, could you tell the difference, you know, if blind, you know, between Russian River, Willamette Valley, Anderson Valley, Sonoma Coast, you know, Santa Rita Hills. I mean, yeah, there are certain things that are markers maybe. But you know what? There's so many, there's so many... somebody stylistic influences on so many of those wines that I'd be hard, you know, I would challenge anyone to say yes, they could definitively name, you know, what is a Willamette Pinot, or by the same token, what is, you know, definitively a Sonoma Coast wine in, you know, tasted blind.
Well, I think we hit on a couple of different points here, and I think maybe when Oregon wines were kind of first massively introduced into the marketplace, they were a better price value than they
mm-hmm.
are today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that maybe and one of the things Francis and I recommend doing all the time is kind of being a little bit ahead of the curve, trying to find that small producer who's just emerging, trying to find that new wine that's just kind of coming out, that offers maybe some better opportunities sometimes for consumers to find better price values.
Right. That's why I think Anderson Valley is because there are a lot of top producers, like, you know, Wells Guthrie and Duckhorn has a project up there. They make a terrific Pinot Noir. You know, and I feel like there's and you know, that's because they can buy fruit, you know, at a cheaper price.
I think that another thing that's very interesting, if you want to find the new wine and you're willing to be a little bit adventurous, and if you find someone who is a local wine merchant or a sommelier or even the waiter at a local restaurant or the wine buyer at a local restaurant who is adventurous,
mm-hmm.
if you can establish a relationship with that person, it's usually the people in the business who get those wines first because by the time the Wine Spectator writes about them, the price is going up.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I think that if you read your book, Educating Peter, you can learn how to talk about wine with those people, and then they can be your partner in exploring this new world and finding those up-and-coming regions.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
I'll go on tour with you.
but Letty, one of the things we just talked about is getting out in front of the curve and maybe finding some new producers. But sometimes even that doesn't help. You recently did an article in Food and Wine about mailing lists and mailing list wines and things like that. And sometimes with these wines, there's so much hype before them before they even come out that the price is inflated even, you know, it's kind of like an IPO coming out.
Right, right, exactly. Well, because they're always the guys in the underground, you know, buzz, that they are the ones that know, you know, that these wines are you know, I mean, like, yeah, but I should say that most of these seem to be Napa cabs. I mean, there are exceptions. There's some Pinots, but, you know, the prices and the expectations, like Ovid Vineyards, you know, one that I found out just through a collector friend of mine, and there's so many of these wineries. They've yet to produce wines, and yet their initial offering may be, and I don't, some of them haven't even named prices yet, but, you know, a couple $100.
You know, it's funny, it's sort of like putting a velvet rope out in front of a club that hasn't opened yet, you know,
right.
It's very much like it. Letty, we need to leave it there. The book was great. I want to thank you for coming on our show and talking with us about it, and we're going to put it up on our website so people can find it.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Letty.
Always lots of fun talking to you guys.
So that's Letty Teague. Food & Wine Magazine is where she writes regularly. Her book is Educating Peter. Find out about it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. The stage left in Catherine Lombardi, restaurants in New Brunswick. You know, Mark, we were talking with Letty Teague. I mentioned briefly that I didn't even get a chance to talk to you about this, but we were invited, and you have four kids, so I went, to the James Beard House yesterday where the nominations were announced for the James Beard Award, which are the Oscars of the food world.
They are the Oscars of the food world,
and
no doubt about it.
And the black tie dinner will be in May. It was cool to be there. And I think we're invited, because we were invited as press to the first, we're invited as press to the second. So get your tuxedo out.
Do you mean get my tuxedo let out? Because
yeah.
That's probably what I need to do.
I recently, you know, you can judge a man. If you wear a tuxedo a couple times a year, it really is a great weight regulator on you, because I've got to get another tuxedo, got to lose 5 or 10 pounds. But Letty's stuff is great, and her articles in Food & Wine Magazine, which is a great magazine, it's published by American Express Publishing, really, really insightful stuff.
We touched on an article that's in this month's Food & Wine, in the April issue of Food & Wine, and it is about mailing list wines and about these kind of cult wines that are so expensive and so difficult to get on a waiting list. I mean, you have a better chance at getting giant season tickets than you do getting Harlan Cabernet.
Well, you know, and some of them are so expensive, but some wines are
And they're and they're cheaper than Harlan Cabernet too.
But some wines are cult wines, and they're not crazy expensive.
Mm.
The reality of the situation is that real wine is made from a certain farm, a certain vineyard, a certain field, and there's only so much of it. And, you know, if 1,000 people want 100 cases of wine, well, there's going to be a price. If 1,000,000 people want that 100 cases of wine, what these wineries do is they establish a mailing list, and they sell basically half or three-quarters to their mailing list and a quarter to a half to fine restaurants, places. And the reason they sell them to restaurants is because they know if they sell a case to a liquor store, that's going
to go to
one person. They sell a case to a restaurant, and five people share each bottle of wine.
It probably goes to 60 people, that same bottle.
It goes to 60 people, and they want to be out there.
But it's got a Gaul, Harlan, for instance. They sell their wine for an exorbitant fee, $300-$500 a bottle, and then someone puts it on the internet and sells it for $1,500 a bottle the next day.
Yeah, kind of crazy. Anyway, we need to run. The news is coming up next. I hope you've enjoyed the hour. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450, the time's 12 noon.